Coming up on Weekend America.
This weekend, Carrie Fisher is dining with her in-laws again.
My husband and I have both worked professionally as chefs, and when we moved in, we made an agreement that my sister and her husband would pay for the groceries and my husband and I would do all the cooking.
This economy makes familiar bedfellows. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. This weekend, Hattie Gray is living in Superman's old place.
Here we go. 150
Have you done this before?
Yeah.
Life's tough when you live in a super landmark. And what will baseball's Tampa Bay Rays do this season if they're desperate?
That's when people want to make all those Faustian bargains with the devil. Just let us win this time. And I think the Devil Rays are going to be without that at the end of the season, having changed their name.
Get behind me, Satan, but I'll call you if I need you. It's Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. This weekend in Cleveland, yet another stranger is going to knock on Hattie Gray's door, and she's going to let that person come in and nose around, because that's what you do when you live in the ancestral home of Superman. We're going to visit Hattie, too, later this hour. What do you suppose you might find in Superman's house?
Well, a cape, of course. And I guess he'd have one of those closets where he changes back into Clark Kent once in a while.
Probably a lot of the button front shirts he has a tendency to rip those off.
Underwear. Maybe some good reading material.
Bright red underwear.
We ain't going to find no kryptonite there, I know that.
Probably a lot of relaxation kind of things. Maybe candles, music. I mean, he doesn't need to work out, so no gym equipment.
Oh, I'd find his secret lair, and it would be way cooler than Batman's. Like, all red and yellow and blue and... his dog, Crypto.
Don't forget his cat, Knight.
Very good. Those voices came from St. Paul, Cincinnati, and Lincoln, Nebraska.
The big story this past week was, of course, the economy. Federal bailouts of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, continuing bad news about the housing and credit markets, major banks writing down billions of dollars in losses.
This week, a former Federal Reserve Bank president, William Poole, said that the Fed chief, Ben Bernanke, has a very tough choice, a small recession now or a much deeper recession later.
Well, we've done a lot of stories over the past several months about how the economy is causing lots of people to have to make really tough choices about their cars and their jobs.
Right. Now we're asking whether this downturn might make us change in even more fundamental ways.
Stephen Vasey is a sociology professor at UC Berkeley, and he studies American individualism and how we all do and don't live or work together. Professor Vasey, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, in a minute, we're going to hear two stories about how the economy is forcing people to really radically rethink how they live. But first, Professor, I want to ask you, do you think we're on a verge of a cultural shift?
My impression is that it would take a lot for a cultural shift to happen. You know, things are getting bad. I mean, certainly in the course of the past 10 years or 20 years or beyond, this is some of the worst that we've seen. But, you know, we're nowhere close to the Great Depression yet. And, you know, I still think we have a long way to go before some of these things get rethought fundamentally. I mean, a lot of these ideas, cowboy out on the range or the independent farmer, the entrepreneur, I mean, these are extremely powerful for, you know, the American consciousness. And so I think we'll have to see some changes that affect a broader portion of the population. And that's obviously starting, but I think it's going to take some more before people start to reevaluate maybe some of their cherished beliefs about what the good life looks like.
Well, some people, as we said, are making real decisions to live differently these days. This weekend in San Francisco, there is a workshop on building yourself a tiny house. The Tumbleweed Tiny House Company is selling plans, and it's giving advice to people who really, really want to downsize. One of those people is Dee Williams of Olympia, Washington. She built a tiny house a few years ago. The house's three light bulbs are powered by solar panels. The propane to heat the house and keep the stove lit costs $8 a month. It's economical and it's also environmental. Here's our story from reporter Joshua McNichols.
Dee Williams' house is very, very small. It's only 8 by 15 feet and 13 feet tall. It's a beautiful house made of natural wood and full of light, but it gets tricky when relatives come to stay.
You know, like having my brother visit, you know, and he brought, like, a piece of luggage.
Dee hasn't always lived in a small house. In Portland, Oregon, she lived in a 1,500-square-foot bungalow.
And like everybody else in Portland, I decided to remodel it. And I loved that house. You know, I spent a lot of time working in order to afford to fix my house up.
Dee found herself at Home Depot a lot, buying construction materials. But she grew uncomfortable with how much she was consuming and how much remodeling consumed her. In the middle of this, she went up to Olympia to help out a close friend dying of cancer. There she found people who were helping each other, not worrying about their houses. It made her look at her own priorities.
And I watched this community outpouring for Mark and his family, and I was like, you know, that's what I want. I want to be a part of a community that is going to help take care of me when I get too sick to take care of myself.
Dee sold her big house in Portland. She ordered plans from the Tumbleweed Tiny House Company and built herself a little house on wheels.
You know, Dee and Hugh and I have been friends for 16 years, I believe. 17 years.
Annie McManus and Hugh O'Neill are among Dee's friends in Olympia. Around the time Dee was building her house, she came up and joined Annie for a walk.
I asked her, so Dee, where are you planning on putting the little house when you move up? And she said, well, I was kind of hoping to put it in your backyard. And we both sort of laughed and realized that that's really what we all wanted.
Dee moved into a new, pared-down life in Olympia. Her wardrobe now includes three outfits and a couple pairs of shoes. She only works 3 days a week, and her utility bills are next to nothing.
I'd run into people, and they're like, oh, where are you living? I'm like, oh, I'm in Hugh and Annie's backyard. You know, which just kind of sounds not quite right.
Dee didn't want to feel like a burden on Hugh and Annie. She did jobs around the house and helped out with her family. Still, she worried about being a mooch. One day, Dee towed her house to a different spot. She told Annie she wasn't coming back. Annie was devastated.
I also remember after I kind of stopped crying a bit, I said, okay, I really want you to do what you want to do, but I really hope it's that you want to come back here. And she did.
That's when Dee realized she'd become family. Now she's been living in Hugh and Annie's backyard for 3 years.
So this skylight over the bed is beautiful. I really love it. I love feeling like nature is right there.
For many of us, our home is our fortress where all our needs are met. Dee's house can't fill all those needs, but she doesn't want an independent life in a bigger house.
I think there are a lot of people that live in these houses but don't feel at home. They don't feel at home in the world. And all of a sudden, I feel so very blessed and so very much at home. And maybe for the first time ever.
In Olympia, Washington, I'm Joshua McNichols for Weekend America.
On some level, that just sounds so utopian. Professor Steve Vasey, he's a sociologist from UC Berkeley. He's with us today. Professor Vasey, I was just wondering, is this increased interdependence that Dee Williams feels, it feels somehow countercultural? It's not really an American ideal, is it?
You know, it's definitely a big factor in America. I mean, we tend to be very individualistic. I mean, if you think of two aphorisms, one that's common in America, one that's common in Japan. In America, we say, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you stand out, you're going to get, you know, you're going to get benefits. If you make yourself known, if things are going to work out for you. Whereas in Japan, you know, the saying is the nail that stands up gets pounded down. So, well, obviously, sort of signifying, you know, fit in with the crowd, conform to the prescriptions of your family and community. So, I mean, there are definitely some cultural differences here, and it is countercultural in America to want to live communally.
You heard Dee Williams say that she feels at home maybe for the first time. A lot of people, that home is a natural place to look. Besides shrinking their house, they look to their family home.
My husband and I and our family has lived in Boston for a long time, and we decided to move to the Philadelphia area to be closer to my sister and her kids.
That's Carrie Fisher. Carrie and her family moved in with her sister, brother-in-law, and their family for what was supposed to be a three-month trial period. They wanted to get the lay of the land before buying their own house. That was 2.5 years ago.
It's working so well from every standpoint, from a financial standpoint, from a social standpoint.
The family is big, but so is the house. Some kids share rooms, but they say they really don't mind that much. Carrie and her husband have 3 kids, and her sister and brother-in-law have 5. So they beat the Brady Bunch by yeah. 2.
You know, we never hear any of the kids. I've never heard them say, I'm bored. Because there's always something to do and there's always something to play with. And of course, they fight sometimes, but, you know, if they're fighting with one sibling or cousin, there's always someone else for them to play with.
Now, the utility bill might be cut in half, but with two families, the chores become supersized. But they've worked that out, too, with a little strategizing.
My husband and I have both worked professionally as chefs. And when we moved in, we made an agreement that my sister and her husband would pay for the groceries and my husband and I would do all the cooking. And it means that they get great meals and don't have to worry about cooking dinner every night. And we get to save a lot of money on food costs. And that kind of setup for the whole house means that we're running one household instead of two. And it's a big household, but it's still less expensive than it would be to run two full households.
Wow, Professor Stephen Vasey of UC Berkeley, moving in with your in-laws sounds so easy.
Well, when I was a kid, actually, when I was about 10, my family, so my brother and myself and my parents moved in with my grandparents who lived, you know, just across town. And we lived with them for about a year. You know, even at 10 years old, I mean, I could feel that some sort of expectations were being violated. You know, I mean, it was great. I mean, it was great to be with my grandparents, you know, all the time. And then this gets back to the kind of trade-offs, you know, we just heard about in the last clip there was that, you know, there really are good things about this. You know, individuals, just because we value it so much doesn't mean that it's universally good. In fact, in some ways, it's very problematic. You know, but my parents, as soon as they were able to, I mean, we bought a house and moved out. So, you know, I don't think that desire for your own space, you know, sort of your own fortress ever really goes away.
You were talking earlier a bit about how there has to be a big force to get Americans to let go of that rugged individualism.
Yeah.
So do you think that this perfect storm of an environmental crisis, a housing crisis, globalization, immigration, the economy, you know, tanking, will these things really cause a permanent change in how we think about how we live?
Well, I mean, certainly, if anything, there's, you know, this sort of emerging talk, and it's, you know, about environmentalism. And I think this is one of the things that's really competing with individualism,
mm-hmm.
is this idea that, you know, individualism is great, but at the same time, it consumes a tremendous amount of resources. You know, we all understand the value of having our own car, but I think when gas is costing $4.50, $4.60, you know, and likely to keep going up, people do, you know, they have sort of an incentive to rethink some of these ideas. And I think, you know, ultimately, that will be a good thing. So, you know, there'll probably be some sort of hybrid, you know, some sort of mix, you know, between these things where people try to balance out the desire to have their own freedom, their own autonomy, you know, their own space, but yet at the same time try to be sensitive of, you know, what impact that they're having, you know, on the world. So, you know, I think that will definitely play a role.
Stephen Vasey is a professor of sociology at the University of California at Berkeley. Professor, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me. Thanks a lot.
I was dying to see what Dee's little house looked like, and there are some great mm-hmm. photos of it at our website. And there's also links to other tiny housing communities. That's at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Yeah, that exterior shot looks comical, like the proportions are totally off. And the inside, the efficiency of her place is beautiful. Go to weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
Coming up, bad jokes on the campaign trail, million-dollar toilets, and a surgeon leaves an unwanted calling card. Good news, bad news, or no news? Next on Weekend America. Thank you. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This is the part of the show when we take stock of the week gone by. We notice some of the week's news stories as they float past, and we ask, wait a minute, is that actually bad news, or is it really good news? Or when you think about it, is it really no news at all? Here to grapple are writer, humorist Patricia Marks. Hi, Patricia.
Hi.
Political consultant Tara Settmayer. Hey, Tara.
Howdy.
And the cartoon editor for a lovely little magazine called The New Yorker. Perhaps you've heard of it. Bob Menkoff, how was your week, Bob?
Sort of uneventful.
Really?
Yeah, I haven't looked at the magazine this week.
Yeah,
it should really be getting some publicity.
Yeah, well, let's do that for The New Yorker. As I'm sure our listeners know, the latest cover portrayed Barack Obama as a Muslim and his wife as a militant, and they're in the Oval Office and a painting of Osama bin Laden over the fireplace where burns the American flag. Both the Obama and John McCain campaigns have denounced this attempt at satire. I ask you, is this, in the big picture, good news, bad news, or no news?
Well, let me take this because I think it's just very, very good news. I know that at The New Yorker, we were so absolutely overjoyed by it,
yeah.
Which is what we do when we have this much joy, is we burn American flags. Get it?
I get it. Does everyone get that? He's being ironic.
That's it. I did think it actually was an extraordinary event because the cover did not work as intended, needless to say.
By the way, you're the cartoon editor, Bob.
Oh, by the way, let me say I have nothing to do with the covers. I am the cartoon editor. Had it been a cartoon, it would have looked just the same, but it would have been Barack Obama saying, "This is just a joke."
I think this is bad news for political satire because, goodness gracious, people, lighten up. It is satire. Now, could there have been things done differently, maybe to put it in context a little bit more? Sure. I mean, hindsight is 20/20, but it's funny because liberals can't laugh at themselves, apparently. You know, God forbid that someone cracks a joke about them. You know, liberals are always being too busy being the victims. God forbid they're the victim of some satire. This is the result.
Patricia?
Well, I hate to agree with everybody. It's not fun, but I think
never
it's,
do that again.
Yeah, I know. It's good news for the laugh track industry because evidently people don't know there's a joke unless they have a cue. I heard a really good joke about this, which is how many Obamas would it take to screw in a light bulb?
How many?
That's not funny.
the funny thing is that, you know, the way jokes work, once you go down the road of how might this joke be misunderstood, you know, even if it didn't work, well, that's the road to unfunniness.
What we saw was a lot of condescension about people that wouldn't get it. Even though we got it, it was going to be taken
right.
The wrong way by people who weren't really as intelligent as we were and as sophisticated. And that was a little
disconcerting.
Repellent, yeah.
It was just this reflex, once again, saying nobody can think this through.
Yeah.
You know, I do think that the joke was not supposed to be about Obama.
No.
Our next topic, John McCain is also suffering from a joke, but it's his own. This week, a blogger repeated a 1986 story from a Tucson newspaper. McCain was speaking at a conference, and he allegedly asked the crowd if they'd heard the one about the woman who's been raped and beaten by a gorilla. She comes to in the hospital and asks her doctor, "Where is that marvelous ape?" Even McCain's allies are admitting he has a politically incorrect sense of humor. But is it good news, bad news, or no news?
Well, I was thinking it was bad news for the statute of limitation rule and things you say.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
I have plenty of bad things to say about McCain and even plenty of bad things to say about his jokes. But that was 20 years ago. I mean, plus he flubbed the joke. The punchline is, how do you think I feel? He never calls, he never writes.
Yes.
It's no news because, yeah, like Patricia said, this was 20 years ago, and the greatest political joke right now or of concern to McCain should be his campaign. Now, and if it's true that he said that he cracked this joke, I mean, obviously it's inappropriate, but I'm not surprised.
Well, and it's just a fantasy joke. It's a stupid joke.
Our next topic. The city of Seattle spent $5 million on 5 public toilets. They were shiny, high-tech, hands-free, self-washing, self-disinfecting. This week, the city put them all up for sale on eBay. They got so filthy and dominated by drug abusers and prostitutes that even people with nowhere else to go would not step into them. Is this clearly bad news, or could it be good news or even no news?
Well, this is what happens when you make something very basic more complicated than it has to be. you know, technology is great, but this is something I think where technology has gone awry, coupled with government bureaucracy. Obviously, people didn't think this through well enough. They placed them in neighborhoods where probably wasn't the best placement for these things. If you have a tendency for drug addicts and prostitution and things like that.
But that's where public toilets are needed.
This is what happens when you remove common sense and decision making out of something as simple as going to the bathroom and keeping a bathroom clean.
So is it good news then that a taxpayer funded boondoggle has been publicly?
Good news for that, yes. Bad news for the taxpayers of Seattle who wasted $5 million on this.
Did anybody look on eBay? I did. And I wrote the seller to ask about shipping. But
what condition are they described as being in? I'm just curious.
Mint.
Yeah.
And there are no bids right now.
Well, I don't think the taxpayers of Seattle want to throw their money down the toilet anymore.
Well put.
A half-assed idea. Gone.
Okay. You've got 30 more seconds. Just get it all out. Flush down, flush.
Right.
Yeah. Our final topic. In Pennsylvania this week, a woman sued her orthopedic surgeon because after he fixed her herniated disc, while she was still unconscious, he rubbed a temporary rose tattoo onto her lower belly. The surgeon says he's done this for many patients to cheer them up, and no one else has complained. Is her lawsuit good news, bad news, or no news?
Well, I think this is concerning news to think that he has the right to put anything on someone's body while they're under anesthesia without their permission. I don't care what it is. He claims that he's trying to do it to cheer them up, but that just seems somewhat overbearing and a violation of privacy.
Good news that she sued him for it?
I think it's certainly bad news for the doctor. Temporary is the key word. I mean, I am not very troubled by it. What the doctor did was the equivalent of leaving a post-it note with a smiley face. I mean, she didn't really get abused.
It's where he put it, though. He put it on below the panty line.
Well, in the article, it said stomach, didn't it, or belly? Or
it said below the panty line is what
it depends on the panty, doesn't it?
Well, if they're bloomers, then that.
Yeah.
I want to say that one man's lower belly is another man's something, and it just doesn't seem like it's going well.
I think it's really bad news for the burgeoning comedy surgeon.
The Patch Adams lobby?
Yeah, really, because, you know, we're going to have a shortage of people who are funny and surgeons who might like tie your internal organs into funny balloon shapes.
That's a New Yorker cartoon.
There you go.
Doesn't this woman realize it was satire?
Yes.
She doesn't read the New Yorker, clearly.
It was a joke that didn't work. That's the news this week. Panel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was political consultant Tara Settmeyer, New Yorker cartoon editor Bob Mankoff, and author and humorist Patricia Marks. Her latest book is Him, Her, Him Again, The End of Him. We'd like to hear what was good, bad, and no news to you this week. You can vote on these topics and suggest your own when you spend time with us at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
This weekend, the Tampa Bay Rays have to face the Toronto Blue Jays, and they have to do it without the devil. That's coming up on Weekend America.
This is Weekend America, the show about what's happening this weekend, like the new Batman movie that's out, The Dark Knight. Now, if you plan to see it this weekend, I hope you already have your tickets because advance online ticket sales have been the highest ever. But Batman isn't the only superhero that's getting a lot of attention this summer. Comic fans are also celebrating the 70th anniversary of the first Superman comic book. The Cleveland house where Jerry Siegel dreamed up that Man of Steel, it's still standing. And thanks to the superhero hype this summer, it's once again become a pilgrimage site for comic book fans. WCPN's Mari Saito paid a visit.
The time? A hot summer night, 1934. The place? Kimberly Street, Glenville, a mostly Jewish neighborhood in Cleveland. Our story begins with Jerry Siegel, a quiet 19-year-old who can't sleep.
Up in the sky, look, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's Superman!
The Man of Steel is born right here in Siegel's house in Cleveland. Fast forward now to the Glenville of 2008. It's 3 o'clock on a summer afternoon. African-American children play on the sidewalks. Older wooden houses line Kimberly Street. But one house stands out. It's painted red and blue. This is the home of Jefferson and Hattie Gray.
Hello?
Thank you.
The Grays moved here in 1983. 3 years later, the city of Cleveland declared it a historic landmark. And then fans started knocking on the door.
Here we go. 150 times.
Have you done this before?
The house is no museum. The Grays raised their 4 children here, but they've always opened their doors for Superman's pilgrims. Jerry Siegel's relatives visited from Florida once and told the Grays what they knew of the superhero's origins.
This could have been Jerry's room right here.
They did most of the writing from that room and the attic.
Plaster is crumbling from the corners of Jerry Siegel's old bedroom. In the back is a space that looks like a closet, but it has a window that overlooks the backyard.
That he looked out the window all the time.
Oh, he would sit here and look out the window?
I guess so.
As our story begins, we ask you to come with us on a far journey, a journey that takes us millions of miles from the Earth, where the planet Krypton burns like a green star in the endless heavens.
At first, Jerry Siegel thought up an evil Superman, but on that hot night in 1934, he changed him into a hero from a dying planet.
You can totally imagine that, can't you?
Yes, because you can.
A kid in a little space like this.
I can nighttime when you're sitting here, and you can just see the sun, the moon, and the sun rising. It's a beautiful view.
After his sleepless night, Siegel ran the 11 blocks to his friend Joe Schuster's apartment. Siegel held drafts of a comic strip plot. Schuster started to sketch out the story of the Man of Steel.
Look, the sky. It's fiery red. The mountains. Look, the mountains are falling in. Jor-El, what's happening?
The end of Krypton, Lara. Just as I foretold.
You all are incredibly gracious. I think most people, if they had random fans knocking on the door saying, "Hi, where's Jerry's bedroom?" they would get kind of sick of it after a while.
Not really, because simple reason, if we could help somebody, so we always did it.
And without any state or local aid, the Grays have opened their home to strangers again and again. Jefferson Gray doesn't mind. He says owning Superman's house has introduced him to people he would have never otherwise met.
So, you know, most time people got frightened about the neighborhood. I'm scared to go in that neighborhood. You know, you have to deal with that all the time. But then when I see people come in with friendly faces, I never heard of one person said one bad thing since they've been coming over here.
Visitors and friends have turned the front porch of the Gray's home into a makeshift shrine decorated with Superman memorabilia. Jefferson Gray says he can't wait for the day when he can explain what it all means to his 1-year-old grandson.
Though the tiny rocket ship roars into the uncharted heavens as the mighty planet of Krypton explodes into millions of glowing fragments.
In Cleveland, I'm Mari Saito for Weekend America.
Does it reach the Earth? Does it find its mark in all the far-flung darkness of space? Remember, don't miss the next installment of Superman.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This is the show about this weekend. In Florida, the Tampa Bay Rays are starting the second half of the baseball season against the Toronto Blue Jays. And the Tampa team is finding itself in new territory. The Rays have been one of the most pathetic teams in baseball since they were founded a decade ago. They have been a doormat, a punchline. But lately, their fans can pick up the sports section with neither dread nor shame, because the Rays are having a great season. Suspiciously great. Weekend America's John Moe wanted to know how they got it turned around.
Last year, Tampa Bay won 61 games, lost 101, worst record in baseball. This year, they're on pace to win about 95 games and have been atop the standings most of the year, all this with the second lowest payroll in the majors. How is this possible? You know what? Don't answer that. It's not possible. But it's happening anyway. Jonah Carey is a baseball writer for ESPN.com. He claims to have an explanation.
So the biggest thing with the Rays' turnaround this season compared to last is that they've had the biggest year-over-year improvement in defense of any team in the last 50 years.
In fact, Jonah has lots of explanations.
That defense, in turn, has improved the results of the starting rotation and the bullpen, just because if pitchers are throwing the ball and guys behind them are catching them, it's going to look better for the pitchers. And that has a cascading effect where...
Enough. Stop. Like most baseball experts, Jonah is omitting a key off-season roster move. Last fall, the team changed their name from the Devil Rays to the Rays. There were marketing reasons. A new name and logo means more merchandise sales. But there had been complaints about the word devil dating back to when the team was founded 10 years ago. People didn't like rooting for Satan, so the team cut him. They got rid of Lucifer, Smokey Jim,
Satan.
And now they're winning. But are they winning because they exercise the devil? Not according to Peter Gilmore, and he's an expert. He's the high priest of the Church of Satan.
The Devil Rays are doing better because they now have to overcome the wimpiness of their new logo. They've got to try to be macho and show people they aren't a bunch of weaklings.
The Devil Rays aren't the only team to embrace El Diablo, of course. The Duke University Blue Devils, Arizona State Sun Devils, the New Jersey Devils of the National Hockey League all have won championships. Peter Gilmore's church doesn't worship Satan. They don't believe in Satan or God, actually. They describe themselves as gourmets of human indulgence, loyal to human experience, like sports.
Essentially, any kind of sport which has competition is part of the struggle for existence, and Satanism is very Darwinian. So wherever you've got victors and losers, that's something that we find as part of our worldview.
So is the head of the Church of Satan a baseball fan?
No, the only sport I follow once in a while is professional wrestling, and that's because a number of our members are part of that profession.
So Peter Gilmore says Satan was a crutch. He's gone, players are stepping up. Well, that's what the Satanists believe. Do the Lutherans agree?
Possibly. Now that, you know, they don't have that other assistance, so to speak.
Wayne Backus is the pastor at Queen Anne Lutheran Church in Seattle. Like Peter Gilmore from the Church of Satan, he credits Tampa Bay's success to compensating for no longer having Black Donald around. Still,
you know, you can't trade on the devil's name for all those many years when now all of a sudden you decide you're going to not use it anymore. The devil's going to get his due if the, you know, former Devil Rays, the Tampa Bay Rays now, continue to do well into the second half. I just sense that there's just going to be this huge fall, this big letdown, and, you know, you're going to hear that devil laughing.
Well, cue the cackle. Satan's vengeance may already be upon the Rays. They lost 7 straight going into the All-Star break. That's right, Tampa. You've made enemies with old Gooseberry. Prepare for smiting.
When you start getting down into those final weeks of the season and you've got a pennant race, it's a really dangerous time, because that's when people want to make all those Faustian bargains with the devil. You know, if you just let us win this time. And I think the Devil Rays are going to be without that at the end of the season, having changed their name.
But what happens if the team vanquishes Lucifer and doesn't collapse? All kidding aside, I wanted to ask Jonah Carey of ESPN a legitimate baseball question. If the Rays win the World Series, will they owe their souls to the Lord of the hoary netherworld?
Indeed they might, and here's another one for you. What if they play the Cubs?
The Chicago Cubs haven't won the World Series in precisely 100 years. They're supposedly victims of a curse involving a goat.
Of course, we know that Satan often, you know, can be described as having the goat hooves and all that stuff. You're getting the 100-year curse versus the curse of Satan versus the goat with the imagery. I don't even know what to make of that. It's possible we might all be swallowed up into the void if that happens.
I'm John Moe. Mwahahaha for Weekend America.
This is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. This weekend, I hope you're relaxing and taking a load off your shoulders, unless you're a resident of Williamsburg in Brooklyn. And in that case, you might be helping shoulder a Giglio. That's a 5-ton monument, nearly 70 feet tall. It takes 100 men to carry it, and it's part of a Catholic tribute to San Paolino. Now, here's the story. Huns overran an Italian village of Nola in about 409 AD, and they took all the men as slaves, and it was San Paolino who eventually got them back. And the festival reenacts the day that the villagers came and welcomed him home. More than a century ago, Italian immigrants from Nola brought that tradition to Williamsburg. And last weekend, they carried the Giglio down the street. This weekend, they're bringing it back. Producer Amber Cortez brings us an audio postcard from last weekend's lift.
Let's hear it for our Feast of Our Lady of Our Father. Yeah. All right.
Well, we're here. We're just about ready to lift. The band is getting into the bandstand now. The Turk's getting up into the boat. There's about 150 lifters here. We're all getting crazy and psyched up for it.
Hey, guys, listen up a second.
Grand Central's a little crazy at rush hour. This is nothing like that. This is chaos, love, enjoyment. My name is Joseph Sparuta. I've been a lifter at the Feast of Our Lady of Mount Carmel for 17 years now. Every year we have the feast. We have a 68-foot-tall structure called the Giglio, which means lily in Italian.
Get over here, you.
And a lifter is one of 100 men who go underneath the structure, and we carry it on our shoulders to an Italian festival band, and we dance it around the streets in honor of St. Paolino of Nola, Italy.
There's musical cues, then they know when to lift at the same time. They know when to do certain dances at the same time, and they are led by a capo.
My name is Joe Peluso. Our family is very lucky in that we have 4 living capos. And in our case, the capo Paranza is the leader of the lifters, the leader of all the men.
Hey, my name is Philip Manna. I became Capo Paranza in 2007.
Number one capo.
It's an honor that all these men respect.
The capo di tutti capo.
And when you walk around, especially in the neighborhood, for 2 years, everybody's going, there's a capo, he's the capo, all the old people, all the young kids.
And he's the choreographer sometimes for the day.
Okay, so my name is Danny Vecchiano, and I am an apprentice capo in the feast. The styles of capo are really how you treat the event. I mean, some people are very, very serious. Some people are having a great time and dancing. And Joe is a showboat, that's for sure.
I might be shuffling around and in a circle and doing some of my the moves that I've become more or less famous for. I do a cha-cha with the structure. Being in front of the structure as a capo is an experience that's very hard to describe. The exhilaration that we get, the adrenaline that flows when we're making a lift.
You know, it's all about heart. It's not about strength. Heart is what raises that Giglio. You have a heart, that thing will fly.
And you're in front of that structure for the first lift of the day, and you've got these thousands of people standing there.
You listen for the commands, and you listen to a capo screaming at you, screaming these commands in Italian, that I tense up, and I know that every fiber of my being and every bit of my strength is going to lift that jail.
And all of a sudden, the music gets to that crescendo in the song that tells the men it's time to lift.
You look at the guy in front of you, you look at the guy next to you, you grab each other's hand, you dig your shoulder in as hard as you can.
And the giglio just goes up into the air, 4, 5, 6 inches off the ground.
It's very warm, it's very compact. Everybody is pressed back to front with a huge structure on your shoulders, and everybody knows everybody there.
Some men are praying, some men are saying names, some men are crying.
And you could see 100 sets of feet just walking in unison, shifting, moving, turning at the same time. And everybody becomes one living creature rather than 100 men under a statue.
I still don't get how they're doing that, but we have some amazing pictures of the giglio and the men who are carrying it and the live band all on their shoulders. Just go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
That 5-ton Giglio monument might feel extra heavy today because it is 94 degrees in Brooklyn. With more about this weekend's weather across America, here's John Moe.
Atchison, Kansas has isolated thunderstorms to go with 89 degrees. Not the kind of weather you'd want to fly in, so eerily appropriate to the Amelia Earhart Festival, with country music, celebrating Earhart's brief Nashville period, and a fun run. The route's kind of interesting. You go out on Main Street, head out past town, and are never heard from again. Ever wonder what it's like to watch a thunderstorm and a baseball game while getting whomped in the face with a pillow? No? Well, Geneva, Illinois lets you find out anyway. The minor league Kane County Cougars host a pillow fight world record attempt amid thunder in 89. They should let base runners carry pillows. You're out! Wham! No, I'm not! Character actor Don Knotts is no longer with us, but his spirit lives on in Morgantown, West Virginia, hosting a festival in his honor under clouds and 89 degrees. Tours, trivia, look-alike contests. In keeping with the theme, event security will be weak-kneed, ineffectual, but still beloved. And will also wear leisure suits and be a landlord to two women and a man in Santa Monica. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
Meet a grandmother who's glad there's no cure for mariachi fever, coming up on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com.
From American Public Media, this is the show about what America is doing this weekend. In Topeka, Kansas, they're wrapping up the 75th annual Fiesta Mexicana with a carnival, jalapeno eating contest, and of course, there's music. Topeka's Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish is having a mariachi mass tomorrow, and the ensemble's lead violinist is Teresa Cuevas. She's 88 years old, and she has not missed a fiesta in 70 years, even after her musical career was almost cut short by an event that shattered an entire community. Reporter Sylvia Maria Gross has her story.
Topeka has a pretty small Latino community. Mariachi is typically played by men. But in 1980, seven women from a church choir became a regional phenomenon, trading the traditional black pants for long maroon skirts. Mariachi Estrella was one of the first all-female mariachi bands in the country. They performed all over Kansas and had some unusual gigs, like serenading some National Guardsmen. 88-year-old Teresa Cuevas' eyes sparkle as she remembers.
We surrounded them and they didn't know what to do. They looked at each other and we kept just getting close to them and, you know, and singing, and we had a good time, and they didn't know how to. I don't know why, but they acted like they didn't know what to do.
And that's the novelty of, because usually, you know, men sing to women instead of the other way around.
And that's serenading them, and we were having a good time. Oh, I enjoyed it, and I'll never forget it as long as I live. Mm-hmm. That was something.
Teresa Cuevas was in her 50s back then, the oldest in a group of boisterous young women, and it meant something special to her. Teresa started playing classical violin when she was 8 years old. She got so good that in junior high, she was invited to play in the Topeka High School Symphony. But when she graduated in the 1930s, musical talent and good grades weren't enough for a young Latina to find a job beyond cleaning offices or sorting eggs.
I know I graduated with quite a number of girls, and I know I wasn't any dumber than they were, and they got the good jobs right away, but I couldn't get any.
So Teresa got married and had five children. But her relationship with her husband was troubled, and she says she wanted to make a name for herself. She started playing violin with the Our Lady of Guadalupe Choir.
The music was a part of me that made me feel like myself, like I used to feel, and that's what helped me to get over that. And I think I grew as a person because I had to get away from feeling that I was nothing.
By the time she was in her 50s, Teresa had divorced her husband, and with her fellow choir members, she found a new love. Band member Rachel Sangalang was 22 at the time.
We called it mariachi fever that we caught. It's mariachi fever. I guess you either love it or, you know, it just happened to strike a chord with us.
Their passion was contagious, and Mariachi Estrella developed a following. In July 1981, they were invited to play in Kansas City at the new Hyatt Regency Hotel. Teresa remembers the whole community was proud.
And the women especially, they said, oh, that is good for you, good for you, for a woman to be playing.
When they got to the hotel, they were on their way to change into their costumes, walking across a second-story skywalk overlooking the lobby when it happened. The skywalk above them suddenly collapsed and brought them all down.
But I was asking God to help me in Spanish. I said, Padre Santo, ayúdame. And I had already made up my mind that I was going to die, but I said it real loud, and then all of a sudden the man said, she's alive, there's a live one. The only thing I could move was this hand. And I grabbed his hand, and they lifted it just a little bit, and they dragged me out of there.
Four of Teresa's band members died in the collapse. 114 people died in all, and more than 200 were injured. The skywalk collapse at Kansas City's Hyatt Regency remains one of the deadliest architectural disasters in U.S. history. And in the Little Guadalupe Parish in Topeka, some families drew their curtains and didn't open them again for years. It took a couple of months before Teresa recovered. She had a crushed vertebra, a concussion, and severe bruising. But as soon as she was back on her feet, she started playing for the choir again in church. The music helped her recover, but she had a different focus now.
I know God saved me, and He saved me so I could be a better mother to my family and keep them together.
Mariachi Estrella played together for a little while, but the surviving members found themselves drawn into their families, and each spun off their own groups. Teresa concentrated on teaching mariachi to her grandchildren, and with them, she kept the name Mariachi Estrella. Now her granddaughters are finishing college.
They both said, Grandma, you know we're going to come back. The trouble is, even though they love mariachi music, but they've seen so many things that they want to do. Isn't that beautiful? What what has opened up for these two girls.
As Teresa's granddaughters pursue their careers, it'll be harder to get Mariachi Estrella together. But at least this weekend, Teresa will be at the church with her band, playing the music she loves best. In Topeka, I'm Sylvia Maria Gross for Weekend America.
One of the women who died in the disaster was Linda Scurlock. Her son Cliff Scurlock went on to become a drummer for the Oklahoma rock band The Flaming Lips. And he credits his mother and the ladies of Mariachi Estrella for his musical inspiration.
And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America.
Yeah, but before you go, we want to hear from you. Now, August is approaching and the mercury is rising, and Weekend America is turning up the heat. We're looking for your hottest, steamiest, most mercury-driven summer stories.
Think Streetcar Named Desire. What would Blanche and Stanley have done without New Orleans' stifling heat? The heat is a character in the story, whispering nothing but bad advice in their ears. So what has searing weather inspired you to do? Tell us your story of one dramatic summer day or night when the temperature was unbearable.
And while you think of some stories for our future shows, we want to thank those that helped produce this show, including Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Millie Jefferson, E.O. Kobe, Philip Stearns, Sam Keenan, Michael Raphael, Tim Bamba, and Angela Kim.
Also, Rob Byers, Susie Lechtenberg, Christina Pena, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, Michael May, Ocean Kalen, Phyllis Owens, John Moe, and Mark Sanchez.
Galactic created our theme music, and our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast of today's program. Just go to weekendamerica.org. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke. It's your weekend. Enjoy it.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Summer's here and Weekend America is celebrating. In our new summer travel series, we'll bring you the sounds of vacation.
That is really good. Okay, stop licking your arm. You got bug spray on it. Oh my God, okay, hang on. How is it?
Good.
From camping trips to spa retreats, Weekend America hits the road. And who knows what we'll discover. Join us for the next Weekend America.